I'm going to give you a far-ranging view of what's going on in the U.S., and it's a rather different approach because we've got a very different situation in the U.S., which I'll describe, but we are dealing with a global situation, and it's important to remember that there's that the issue of information patents, and I use that term to include business method patents, and I'll give you a very broad set of examples what that covers, really takes place at the confluence of a lot of important themes in today's economy. Innovation is a driver of economic growth. Everybody thinks this is very important. Patents are supposed to contribute to it. The importance of intangible assets, especially for developed economies, this is a key source of competitive advantage for advanced economies. And the importance of technology and the internet, which has been a rationale, the importance of the internet, the importance of electronic commerce has been one of the key stated rationales for expanding subject matter protection. Now, the simple argument that because it's important, we need to protect it. And then finally here, the globalization of commerce and the tension between the desire to harmonize commerce, to increase globalization, and the more difficult thing to talk about, which is national or regional strategy. It may not make sense for Europe to harmonize with the U.S., and certainly Europe has been resistant to harmonizing with the U.S. on business methods. Just to go over some of the basic differences between copyright and patent, I don't know how much you covered this, but of course copyright is fairly thin protection. It doesn't protect factual information. It just protects the expression. So it doesn't protect the content of a scholarly article. It just protects the way it's expressed. But patent addresses knowledge, and it's invention rather than expression, and it's novelty rather than originality. And this has important implications because for the flow of knowledge and information, because you can't have independent creation under a patent system. And in copyright, you can have independent creation, and there's no threshold. It's a very low overhead system. Protection is automatic. Whereas with the patent system, it's high overhead. You have to apply for a patent. It has to be examined, and that's very costly. The rationale is ultimately very different. There's an ethical rationale for copyright, and historically this is more true in Europe because of the natural rights theory than it is in the U.S. In the U.S., we tend to see both as utilitarian, but nonetheless, copyright has an ethical dimension that patent has. That patent doesn't have. We don't have criminal penalties for patent infringement, but there are for copyright infringement. And finally, what I mean here is that copyright is really more directed at behavior, that we consider inappropriate, like piracy. Whereas patents is a pure property regime, so it's concerned with defining boundaries, just like real property. Here are the recent European developments. I assume you're all fairly familiar with what's going on here. The issue of patents for computer software came up in the context of the community patent. Very little attention to them, and only a page and a half here on software patents. Then, following some criticism, they commissioned a study by the Intellectual Property Institute in London, supposedly on the economic impact. Most of it is written by lawyers. There was an economist on the job, but the economics piece is only one section, and it is very skeptical. Doesn't come to any conclusions. There was clearly some tension between the economist who wrote that section and the two lawyers that wrote the rest of the report. This was published in March 2000, followed by a public consultation. And, of course, the draft software patent directive came out early this year, focuses on subject matter, pretty much ignores the quality problem. I added this because you should be aware that there are negotiations going on in WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, around harmonization of substantive patent law. And there is a big confrontation between, pretty much between the U.S. and the rest of the world, because the U.S. is proposing to do away with technological limits, to require countries to do away with technological limits on patenting so that business methods would be patentable. It's, in fact, the standard the U.S. is proposing is any field of activity. Here's some recent U.S. developments. The State Street Bank decision, which basically said there are no limits on software patents and business methods are patentable. There are some ongoing projects that we don't have any conclusion from. The National Academy study, a report will be out in January of this coming year. Now, this is broader than information patents. It's going to include biotech. It's going to include some general discussion of the operation of the patent system, and it's going to include something on how universities manage patents. There's a ongoing study by the Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Justice, which I've been participating in, and I'm going to talk about that at a little more length because there's some very interesting material in the record that's coming out of that. PTO has been under criticism for quality and has published a strategic plan which emphasizes outsourcing of the examination process and a sort of flexible examination process. So you don't have to, once you start it, you don't have to go all the way. You just pay as you go, depending on if you're ready to get the patent or not. And the idea is that will reduce some of the load on the patent office. And I mentioned that substantive patent law treaty, this meeting is coming up in November. This has gotten very little press. Does anybody know about this? Is anybody in the room aware of this? I mean, this is really a very remarkable scenario, and it's the U.S. at its unilateral worst, I'm afraid. State Street Bank case. Okay, I said something about this, but let me say a few other contextual things. The decision makes no policy argument whatsoever on looking at the business method side of the decision. It doesn't make one on the software side either. But you should know that at that time, there was no pressure on Congress to make business methods patentable. The decision was made on the basis of the 1952 Patent Act. However, there's no record that business methods were discussed at the time of the 1952 Patent Act. It was what we call hornbook law. There were cases that seemed to say that business methods weren't patentable, so all the legal treatises say that business methods aren't patentable, and everybody assumed that they weren't patentable. The decision is written by a former patent lawyer who drafted the 1952 Act, but he doesn't acknowledge this in his decision. He doesn't acknowledge his own views expressed in a law review article written after the Act, which seemed to indicate that he thought business methods were not patentable, nor his article, which he describes congressional intent, and says Congress really didn't intend much of anything in the 1952 Act other than to entrust this small group of patent lawyers to codify the Act. So the U.S. standard at the moment, and Reiner mentioned it, but it's a pretty meaningless standard. It's anything that produces results in any field of activity. It's supposed to be tangible, concrete, and practical results. Practical is the same as the utility standard, and tangible and concrete aren't defined, so they're anything that our appellate court says they mean. because they haven't defined them yet. But basically, here are some of the things that you see patents on: the logical processes, any functionality in software, from code to code to function at the high level. So that's similar to the level of the one-click patent. Social processes, business practices, including best practices. I mentioned this because of the European interest in best practices. But basically, these best practices are now patentable. We don't have the same focus on best practices in the U.S. Purposeful use of information, and you see this in the controversy around gene fragments. That is to say, patents that make use of information to inform future action. That is, we know this gene fragment is associated with multiple sclerosis, and therefore it's useful in research on treating multiple sclerosis. Data structures, instructional methods, and what this new standard that you see in the WIPO discussions looks like is that it could apply to scientific discoveries. As long as they can point to some possible use, as long as they could be useful in further research. Common themes. Okay, we've had this erosion of subject matter limitations on both sides of the Atlantic. It's gone further in the U.S. The policy development until the European Commission's process has been pretty much strictly judicial or quasi-judicial. And it's been invariably addressed until recently as a legal problem and not as an economic or policy problem. Most importantly, we have built into the TRIPS agreement, which is now part of the WTO charter, this requirement that all technologies be treated the same. One size fits all. This provision was put in at the behest of the drug industry. There was no discussion at the time of whether it applied to computer software. So what you have here is the prospect that information innovation is being assimilated to what is basically an industrial age system. Okay, this is to give you a sense of what the institutional environment is like and why quality is an issue in the U.S. Here are the stated performance goal and mission of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. An expansionist performance goal, explicitly expansionist, and a mission to help customers get patents. So essentially defining their customers as patent applicants as their customers, not the public. This is embarrassing even to the patent bar. They feel that those facing patents and those applying for patents should be given equal billing. Okay, I'm coming back now to these FTC hearings. PTO has participated in them. They're nominally joint with the Justice Department, but the FTC has really taken the lead, and I think it's pretty clear that they're going to shape the final product. It's not clear that they're going to even do a joint final product, but I'm pretty sure the FTC is going to do a final report. So these have been concerned, obviously, with a patent and antitrust interface, since FTC is our competition agency, as is the Justice Department in somewhat different ways. But they're also concerned with substantive patent law, because there has been this growing concern that maybe patent law itself needs to be tweaked because of anti-competitive effects. So I'm going to give you some excerpts from the hearings in California on business methods. And I think these are particularly interesting because you don't usually hear this kind of testimony in Washington. So this is what happens when you hold them on the other side of the country. And they're held, instead of by the Patent and Trademark Office, they're held by a competition agency. And what you see in them are examples of those phenomena at the bottom. So here's one. Here's Cadence Design Systems, Director of Intellectual Property, saying the quality of information coming out of software patents is so bad you can't even use it for competitive purposes. Too much information. And here's Texas Instruments. Now, Texas Instruments is known for its aggressive use of its patent portfolio. There are several companies that qualify. Texas Instruments, IBM, and Lucent are perhaps the best known. But even Texas Instruments says they can't manage the information that's in their own portfolio. Here's a small company who says he's sitting on sitting with a nuclear bomb on top of my products that could go off at any point and cause me simply not to have a business anymore. And from Cisco Systems, I mean, bear in mind that we're moving out of pure software into information technology more broadly, and this was kind of surprising to me. Basically says the costs of the system outweigh the benefits. So here are some of the fundamental challenges of patent policy, and I'm speaking very generally, and then I'm going to focus in on information technology. The extreme complexity of the law and practice. So basically only patent lawyers understand what's going on here. And this has been a real problem in academic analysis, because economists have been very interested in patent law too. But most of the work by economists is theoretical modeling, and they really don't understand what goes on at a practical level in the patent system. Moreover, there is very little interaction between economists and lawyers in the development of patent policy. It's pretty much all done by lawyers. And there are venues in the U.S., like the National Academy, where lawyers and economists do interact. But my experience is there's less of that in Europe than there is in the U.S., and there's not much in the U.S. It's important to understand that although patents aren't a traditional regulatory system, like telecom regulation, they actually are a regulatory system that's enabled by the public grant of property rights. So it's really a private regulatory environment, which is determined by those that hold the patents. This means that we basically have very little empirical data on what goes on out there in the real business world. You know, we know how many patents are being granted. We know about the patents in litigation. But we have no idea what goes on in between. And that's where the real action is. Furthermore, the analytic focus, that is the body of case law that tells us about the patent system, is all focused on individual patents, the validity of individual patents, and whether or not somebody else's technology infringes on it. So it's a focus on the individual level, and there's no way you can aggregate that information to get a picture of what's going on at the portfolio level. There's this ideology of non-discrimination, which I mentioned is embodied in TRIPS. And this is, you can think of this as the lawyers telling the economists, don't even bother to do empirical research here, because it's going to be one size fits all, and whatever you find out, that if you find out the software industry is different from the pharmaceutical industry, we're not going to pay any attention to it. Capture of the policy development process. This is at, I would say, at three different levels. One is the PTO, the Patent and Trademark Office itself, and you saw that in their mission statement. Secondly is the intermediary capture, that is the people who understand the system are the patent lawyers, and they benefit from that. And they benefit from increasing the throughput of the system. They earn their living from the throughput of the system rather than the quality of the system. And then finally, the specialized court that we have in the U.S. Has turned out to be, this was a court created in the early 80s to make appellate decisions uniform across the country, because the different appellate courts seem to have different standards on whether they would uphold patents. So there was a lot of forum shopping going on. If you were a patentee, you'd want to go and sue, you'd want to sue in a friendly circuit. But that court has turned out to be very pro-patent in a lot of respects, and what we have is a very low standard of non-obviousness as a result. We basically only have a novelty standard in the U.S. The utility standard is almost meaningless, and the non-obviousness standard, which you call inventive step here, is very low. The gulf between legal and economic analysis I've mentioned, but you could compare that with the way that lawyers and economists interact in other areas of the law, like telecom regulation or like competition policy. And there are missing disciplinary perspectives, which I won't get into. But I do want to show you this, which is the cost of patent litigation in the U.S. There are only 75 patent cases that go to full trial each year in the U.S. Now, you might think, well, that's not very much litigation, so where's the big problem here? Well, 1,700 suits are filed each year. And we have no idea how many notice letters are written and received each year. It could be hundreds of thousands, and it could be millions. And this is why patent disputes don't go to full litigation, because you can't afford it unless huge amounts are at stake. So if you look at that first row there, that says that when the amount in controversy, this is the amount in the plaintiff's complaint against the defendant, is less than $1 million, the cost of taking this to full trial will be $499,000 per side. So the amount, since this is the bracketing category, the amount is going to be less, average amount is going to be less than $1 million, and it's going to be more than eaten up by the transaction costs, the costs of litigating. So this basically tells you why patents are a bad deal for small companies, because they can't afford to prosecute them and they can't afford to defend against them. Actually, they can afford to prosecute them if they can, you know, they can sell an interest in it or work with a contingency law firm. But you can't do that as a defender. Also note this. Gone up 25% in 2 years. So the legal assistance is a seller's market. Now, the big question is, why is software different? Because you'll hear this from patent lawyers all the time. And this is something I've thought a lot about, and you can approach it from different directions. And while almost none of these are necessarily unique to software, the aggregate is such that it's, you know, it's reasonable to deduce that software, that patents may be beneficial in other industries, although the empirical evidence shows that that's only clearly the case. They are only clearly perceived as valuable in pharmaceuticals and chemicals. So, but if you weigh the cumulative effect of these factors, you could conceivably get a negative conclusion. The granularity, the complexity, there's a lot of possible functions in a single product, the cumulative nature of innovation. And when innovation is cumulative, that means that the initial inventors hold power over the sequential inventors who have to build on the initial innovation. And the high value of things that aren't patentable, design and especially integration and debugging. And here is a diagram of the basic problem that I've described there. The thinking is that in pharmaceuticals and chemicals, where most companies like the system, it's one patent per product, or that's what it's been traditionally. So you have a fairly good congruence between what goes out in the market and the patent system. The basic problem with software is there are many possible patents within a single product. Know, perhaps tens of thousands of patentable functions in a commercial software program. So this is the anti-commons problem. Too many property interests or potential property interests. And the tricky thing is that the business method problem is kind of the opposite. The real problem with many of these business method patents is the breadth. So that you can have one patent covering many possible implementations. Even IBM doesn't like business method patents because they feel that it preempts competition at a technological level. So some other reasons, the rapidity of the innovation, it doesn't comport with the cycles, the patent system cycles, which are, you don't get a patent coming out until an average of 36 months afterwards. You don't even get publication until 18 months. Does not fit with cycles in the software industry where you have product cycles of 9 to 18 months. High volume of innovation, difficulty in organizing information about prior art because, well, for tacit knowledge becomes embedded in software, that software developers write from scratch rather than from using libraries. The documentation is, software code can be documented, but this documentation is lost in the compilation. There's a limited journal literature compared to other technical subjects and a volatile vocabulary. So things that are expressed one way today weren't expressed the same way 10, 20 years ago. And remember, there were, as Rayner said, there were many years before patents were allowed. Basically, software went for three decades or so without patents. So there's a huge amount of prior art out there. A highly competitive industry that, and you see this in the FTC testimony, that for the information technology industry generally, that the motivation is competition rather than intellectual property. Extreme heterogeneity, so you don't get the ease of cross-licensing that you do in more in industries where there are high barriers to entry and every player is more or less the same size. There, it sort of goes together. Pervades all sectors of the economy, including the service sector. No markets for components. Okay, so this is the dream of some patent scholars, that you, if we had patents, ubiquitous patents on software, then that would enable people to trade information about their technologies without fear that others were going to rip it off. And so you could have more vigorous markets for components, and components have been sort of the holy grail of software engineering. But we still don't really have a market for components.